323, Chapter 23.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion.
Episode 323, Sweet Jasmine.
This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you.
Greetings and salutations. I hope your week has been marvelous. I am in a very happy mood. I have not been hospitalized in the last week, so I'm feeling great. A little tired, a little achy. We still don't know what happened with the immobility of my entire left arm, but we do know this. My father had had a reaction to a pneumonia shot at some point. I started to suspect that there might have been gluten somewhere in a binder or something like that in the pneumonia shot, but evidently there was just something else. My dad never had a reaction like this. He got sore, but it's 2 weeks out and my arm still hurts like a crazy thing if I try to lift it laterally, which is, I know, the hardest way to lift your arm in the first place. I mean, that's where, if you're going to do strength training, you need to do that. But this is a little ridiculous. So, but I can knit and I can Zentangle and I can cook and clean and all of those things. So definitely on the mend. Thank you for your sweet and wonderful emails. I am really glad so many of you enjoyed getting to hear someone chant Torah, because if you're not Jewish, it's something you probably haven't heard. The Old Testament, the original five books of Moses in the original Hebrew, which is kind of cool, I think. And you heard a tiny, tiny piece of what the boy had to learn. It went on and on. There were three chunks and lots of chanting. But as I said last week, this month is crazy busy. And so I am going to move along rather quickly. The name of this week's episode is Sweet Jasmine. And that's because we have released the fourth sock in the Grounded series. There's four more to go. We've released Rosie's Firestarter, Izzy's Bouncin' Blues, Jen's Subtle Magics, and this week is Jasmine's Ethereal Socks. Jasmine is a Jamaican woman in Grounded. She is psychic and really awesome, and all the kids call her Jazz. And she's just one of those beautiful, I don't know, have you met these people before? They just kind of seem to float. They don't really seem to be part of our world. When I was writing, that was kind of my image of Jasmine, was that kind of person. I've known a couple of them in my life, and they're always extraordinary, and I always want to be them or look like them or somehow embody that grace and elegance. And yeah, so that hasn't happened, because what I do is I wear Levi's and white t-shirts and and stomp around in clogs. So there went that dream, but that's okay. I'll be fine. We also have our giveaway for the month, Inspired Fair Isle Knits, the hardback book by Fiona Ellis, 20 creative designs inspired by the elements, a lovely book. Even if you don't wind up winning it, you should really take a look. She has air, fire, earth, and water. And like I said last week, if you've read Grounded, you will know why those are near and dear to my heart as well. Those of you who are in NaNoWriMo, please feel free to, I guess you kind of friend people on NaNoWriMo. It's harder than it is on Facebook, but I am Mama O, all one word, and you are more than welcome to ping me on there. I was up to date until yesterday, and then life intervened. So I'm going to try and catch up between today and tomorrow again and see if I can get the mojo back. But I'm working on Shattered, which is the sequel to Grounded, and it's coming along rather well. So I'm hoping within the year we will have the sequel ready for you. If you are on Goodreads, Grounded is the November read for the Ravelry Knitters Goodreads group. If, as you're reading, you have any questions that you want to ask, please post them in the forum. I am more than happy to respond. We can also, on the Grounded page on Goodreads, I think, do that kind of Q&A thing if you are so inclined. And I'm happy to let you know what my answers are. And I think that's it for my yammeriness. For now, we have a really good chapter of The Age of Innocence. Now, if you recall where we left off last week, Archer had just found out that Madame Olenska was in Boston. And I think, aren't they in Nantucket, I think? Which is awfully close. So now he's going, right? We know he's going to go and find Madame Olenska. Which means, what? He's going to be alone in Boston with Madame Olenska? Hello? Trouble in paradise? I mean, it's not paradise. We know it's not paradise. But here we've got, you know, May and her mother. They spend their days. They make sure their days are very planned in all these little kind of meaningless little tasks. Oh, we'll visit here. Oh, we'll go there. Oh, it's another party that was just like the party yesterday. And, you know, Newland keeps trying to do something else, other, something more different. And now he has a chance to go to Boston. Mm. And see Ellen. And listen to how he rationalizes it. It is one of these brutal lines that Edith Wharton just drops on you and then whisks away with the rest of the story. And if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't hear it. But it's within the first couple of minutes of this chapter. And then the rest of this, I think I'm just going to let you discover while you listen. The only thing that's weird is the name of the cab that they get into. It's a Herdic cab, H-E-R-D-I-C, and evidently it was unique because it was a rear entry cab, kind of like a, I guess it was almost verging on being an omnibus, that it could carry more than just one or two people in the back, almost like a paddy wagon, but, you know, drawn by horses. That's the closest thing I can think of. I'm going to put some links to pictures and a picture of Mr. Herdic, in fact, on the show notes for you this week. But that's really the only term or anything that's at all odd in this chapter. So I'm going to hand you over to Brenda Dane to read you chapter 23 of The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton.
Chapter 23. The next morning, when Archer got out of the Fall River train, he emerged upon a steaming midsummer Boston. The streets near the station were full of the smell of beer and coffee and decaying fruit, and a shirt-sleeve populace moved through them with the intimate abandon of boarders going down the passage to the bathroom. Archer found a cab and drove to the Somerset Club for breakfast. Even the fashionable quarters had the air of untidy domesticity, to which no excessive heat ever degrades the European cities. Caretakers in calico lounged on the doorsteps of the wealthy, and the common looked like a pleasure ground on the morrow of a Masonic picnic. If Archer had tried to imagine Ellen Olenska in improbable scenes, he could not have called up any into which it was more difficult to fit her than this heat-prostrated and deserted Boston. He breakfasted with appetite and method, beginning with a slice of melon and studying a morning paper while he waited for his toast and scrambled eggs. A new sense of energy and activity had possessed him ever since he had announced to May the night before that he had business in Boston and should take the Fall River boat that night and go on to New York the following evening. It had always been understood that he would return to town early in the week, and when he got back from his expedition to Portsmouth, a letter from the office, which fate had conspicuously placed on a corner of the hall table, sufficed to justify his sudden change of plan. He was even ashamed of the ease with which the whole thing had been done. It reminded him for an uncomfortable moment of Lawrence Lefferts's masterly contrivances for securing his freedom. But this did not long trouble him, for he was not in an analytic mood. After breakfast, he smoked a cigarette and glanced over the Commercial Advertiser. While he was thus engaged, two or three men he knew came in, and the usual greetings were exchanged. It was the same world, after all, though he had such a queer sense of having slipped through the meshes of time and space. He looked at his watch, and finding that it was 9:30, got up and went into the writing room. There he wrote a few lines and ordered a messenger to take a cab to the Parker House and wait for the answer. He then sat down behind another newspaper and tried to calculate how long it would take a cab to get to the Parker House. "The lady was out, sir," he suddenly heard a waiter's voice at his elbow and stammered, "Out?" as if it were a word in a strange language. He got up and went into the hall. It must be a mistake. She could not be out at that hour. He flushed with anger at his own stupidity. Why had he not sent the note as soon as he arrived? He found his hat and stick and went forth into the street. The city had suddenly become as strange and vast and empty as if he were a traveler from distant lands. For a moment, he stood on the doorstep, hesitating. Then he decided to go to the Parker House. What if the messenger had been misinformed and she were still there? He started to walk across the common, and on the first bench, under a tree, he saw her sitting. She had a gray silk sunshade over her head. How could he ever have imagined her with a pink one? As he approached, he was struck by her listless attitude. She sat there as if she had nothing else to do. He saw her drooping profile, and the knot of hair fastened low in the neck under her dark hat, and the long, wrinkled glove on the hand that held the sunshade. He came a step or two nearer, and she turned and looked at him. "Oh," she said, and for the first time he noticed a startled look on her face. But in another moment it gave way to a slow smile of wonder and contentment. "Oh," she murmured again on a different note, as he stood looking down at her, and without rising she made a place for him on the bench. "I'm here on business, just got here," Archer explained, and, without knowing why, he suddenly began to feign astonishment at seeing her. "But what on earth are you doing in this wilderness?" He had really no idea what he was saying. He felt as if he were shouting at her across endless distances, and she might vanish again before he could overtake her. "I? Oh, I'm here on business, too," she answered, turning her head towards him so that they were face to face. The words hardly reached him. He was aware only of her voice and of the startling fact that not an echo of it had remained in his memory. He had not even remembered that it was low-pitched, with a faint roughness on the consonants. "You do your hair differently," he said, his heart beating as if he had uttered something irrevocable. "Differently? Oh, no, it's only that I do it as best I can when I'm without Nastasia." "Nastasia, but isn't she with you?" "No, I'm alone. For 2 days it was not worthwhile to bring her." "You're alone? At the Parker House?" She looked at him with a flash of her old malice. "Does it strike you as dangerous?" "No, not dangerous, but unconventional." "I see. I suppose it is." She considered a moment. "I hadn't thought of it because I've just done something so much more unconventional. The faint tinge of irony lingered in her eyes. I've just refused to take back a sum of money that belonged to me. Archer sprang up and moved a step or two away. She had furled her parasol and sat absently drawing patterns on the gravel. Presently he came back and stood before her. Someone has come here to meet you. Yes. With this offer. She nodded. And you refused because of the conditions. I refused, she said after a moment. He sat down by her again. What were the conditions? Oh, they were not onerous, just to sit at the head of his table now and then. There was another interval of silence. Archer's heart had slammed itself shut in the queer way it had, and he sat vainly groping for a word. He wants you back. At any price? Well, a considerable price. At least the sum is considerable for me. He paused again, beating about the question he felt he must put. It was to meet him here that you came? She stared and then burst into a laugh. Meet him? My husband? Here? At this season, he's always at Cowes or Baden. He sent someone. Yes. With a letter? She shook her head. No, just a message. He never writes. I don't think I've had more than one letter from him. The allusion brought the color to her cheek, and it reflected itself in Archer's vivid blush. Why does he never write? Why should he? What does one have secretaries for? The young man's blush deepened. She had pronounced the word as if it had no more significance than any other in her vocabulary. For a moment, it was on the tip of his tongue to ask, did he send his secretary then? But the remembrance of Count Olenski's only letter to his wife was too present to him. He paused again and then took another plunge. And the person? The emissary? The emissary, Madame Olenska rejoined, still smiling, might, for all I care, have left already. But he has insisted on waiting till this evening. In case, on the chance, and you came out here to think the chance over. I came out to get a breath of air. The hotel's too stifling. I'm taking the afternoon train back to Portsmouth. They sat, silent, not looking at each other, but straight ahead at the people passing along the path. Finally, she turned her eyes again to his face and said, "You're not changed." He felt like answering, "I was, till I saw you again," but instead he stood up abruptly and glanced about him at the untidy, sweltering park. "This is horrible. Why shouldn't we go out a little on the bay? There's a breeze, and it will be cooler. We might take the steamboat down to Point Arley." She glanced up at him hesitatingly, and he went on. "On a Monday morning, there won't be anybody on the boat. My train doesn't leave till evening. I'm going back to New York. Why shouldn't we?" he insisted, looking down at her, and suddenly he broke out. "Haven't we done all we could?" "Oh," she murmured again. She stood up and reopened her sunshade, glancing about her as if to take counsel of the scene and reassure herself of the impossibility of remaining in it. Then her eyes returned to his face. "You mustn't say things like that to me," she said. "I'll say anything you like, or nothing. I won't open my mouth unless you tell me to. What harm can it do anybody? All I want is to listen to you." She drew out a little gold-faced watch on an enameled chain. "Oh, don't calculate," he broke out. "Give me the day. I want to get you away from that man. At what time was he coming?" Her color rose again. "At 11. "Then you must come at once. You needn't be afraid if I don't come. Nor you either, if you do. I swear, I only want to hear about you, to know what you've been doing. It's 100 years since we've met. It may be another 100 before we meet again." She still wavered, her anxious eyes on his face. Why didn't you come down to the beach to fetch me the day I was at Granny's? She asked. Because you didn't look around. Because you didn't know I was there. I swore I wouldn't unless you looked round. He laughed as the childishness of the confession struck him. But I didn't look on purpose. On purpose? I knew you were there. When you drove in, I recognized the ponies, so I went down to the beach. To get away from me as far as you could. She repeated in a low voice, to get away from you as far as I could. He laughed out again, this time in boyish satisfaction. Well, you see, it's no use. I may as well tell you, he added, that the business I came here for was just to find you. But look here, we must start or we shall miss our boat. Our boat? She frowned perplexedly and then smiled. Oh, but I must go back to the hotel first. I must leave a note. As many notes as you please. You can write here. He drew out a note case and one of the new stylographic pens. I've even got an envelope. You see how everything's predestined? There, steady the thing on your knee, and I'll get the pen going in a second. They have to be humored. Wait. He banged the hand that held the pen against the back of the bench. It's like jerking down the mercury in a thermometer, just a trick. Now try. She laughed, and bending over the sheet of paper which he had laid on his note-case, began to write. Archer walked away a few steps, staring with radiant, unseeing eyes at the passers-by, who, in their turn, paused to stare at the unwanted sight of a fashionably dressed lady writing a note on her knee on a bench in the common. Madame Olenska slipped the sheet into the envelope, wrote a name on it, and put it into her pocket. Then she, too, stood up. They walked back towards Beacon Street, and near the club, Archer caught sight of the plush-lined Herdic, which had carried his note to the Parker House, and whose driver was reposing from this effort by bathing his brow at the corner hydrant. I told you everything was predestined. Here's a cab for us, you see? They laughed, astonished at the miracle of picking up a public conveyance at that hour, and in that unlikely spot, in a city where cab stands were still a foreign novelty. Archer, looking at his watch, saw that there was time to drive to the Parker House before going to the steamboat landing. They rattled through the hot streets and drew up at the door of the hotel. Archer held out his hand for the letter. "Shall I take it in?" he asked. But Madame Olenska, shaking her head, sprang out and disappeared through the glazed doors. It was barely 10:30. But what if the emissary, impatient for her reply, and not knowing how else to employ his time, were already seated among the travelers, with cooling drinks at their elbows, of whom Archer had caught a glimpse as she went in? He waited, pacing up and down before the Herdic. A Sicilian youth with eyes like Nastasia's offered to shine his boots, and an Irish matron to sell him peaches, and every few moments the doors opened to let out hot men with straw hats tilted far back, who glanced at him as they went by. He marveled that the door should open so often, and that all the people it let out should look so like each other, and so like all the other hot men who, at that hour, through the length and breadth of the land, were passing continuously in and out of the swinging doors of hotels. And then, suddenly, came a face that he could not relate to the other faces. He caught but a flash of it, for his pacings had carried him to the farthest point of his beat, and it was in turning back to the hotel that he saw, in a group of typical countenances, the lank and weary, the round and surprised, the lantern-jawed and mild, this other face that was so many more things at once and things so different. It was that of a young man, pale, too, and half extinguished by the heat or worry or both, but somehow quicker, vivider, more conscious, or perhaps seeming so because he was so different. Archer hung a moment on a thin thread of memory, but it snapped and floated off with a disappearing face, apparently that of some foreign businessman looking doubly foreign in such a setting. He vanished in the stream of passers-by, and Archer resumed his patrol. He did not care to be seen, watch in hand within view of the hotel, and his unaided reckoning of the lapse of time led him to conclude that if Madame Olenska was so long in reappearing, it could only be because she had met the emissary and been waylaid by him. At the thought, Archer's apprehension rose to anguish. "If she doesn't come soon, I'll go in and find her," he said. The doors swung open again, and she was at his side. They got into the Herdic, and as it drove off, he took out his watch and saw that she had been absent just 3 minutes. In the clatter of loose windows that made talk impossible, they bumped over the disjointed cobblestones to the wharf. Seated side by side on a bench of the half-empty boat, they found that they had hardly anything to say to each other, or rather, that what they had to say communicated itself best in the blessed silence of their release and their isolation. As the paddle wheels began to turn, and wharves and shipping to recede through the veil of heat, it seemed to Archer that everything in the old familiar world of habit was receding also. He longed to ask Madame Olenska if she did not have the same feeling, the feeling that they were starting on some long voyage from which they might never return. But he was afraid to say it, or anything else that might disturb the delicate balance of her trust in him. In reality, he had no wish to betray that trust. There had been days and nights when the memory of their kiss had burned and burned on his lips, the day before even on the drive to Portsmouth. The thought of her had run through him like fire. But now that she was beside him, and they were drifting forth into this unknown world, they seemed to have reached the kind of deeper nearness that a touch may sunder. As the boat left the harbor and turned seaward, a breeze stirred about them, and the bay broke up into long, oily undulations, then into ripples tipped with spray. The fog of sultriness still hung over the city, but ahead lay a fresh world of ruffled waters with lighthouses in the sun. Madame Olenska, leaning back against the boat rail, drank in the coolness between parted lips. She had wound a long veil about her hat, but it left her face uncovered, and Archer was struck by the tranquil gaiety of her expression. She seemed to take their adventure as a matter of course, and to be neither in fear of unexpected encounters nor, what was worse, unduly elated by their possibility. In the bare dining room of the inn, which he had hoped they would have to themselves, they found a strident party of innocent-looking young men and women, schoolteachers on a holiday, the landlord told them, and Archer's heart sank at the idea of having to talk through their noise. "This is hopeless. I'll ask for a private room," he said. And Madame Olenska, without offering any objection, waited while he went in search of it. The room opened on a long wooden veranda, with the sea coming in at the windows. It was bare and cool, with a table covered with a coarse checkered cloth and adorned by a bottle of pickles and a blueberry pie under a cage. No more guileless-looking cabinet particulière ever offered its shelter to a clandestine couple. Archer fancied he saw the sense of its reassurance in the faintly amused smile with which Madame Olenska sat down opposite to him. A woman who had run away from her husband, and reputedly with another man, was likely to have mastered the art of taking things for granted. But something in the quality of her composure took the edge from his irony. "By being so quiet, so unsurprised, and so simple. She had managed to brush away the conventions and make him feel that to seek to be alone was the natural thing for two old friends who had so much to say to each other. End of chapter 23.
So next week, we get to hear their conversation next week. But for now, Ellen knew that Archer was there, watching her out by the water, and didn't turn around on purpose. And it's interesting because everything seems so kind of haphazard and accidental, but that one time when they could have made definite contact out of the way of everybody's eyes and all of that, they specifically made choices that denied them that opportunity. And now that Newland is there and able to see her, now he does another one of these little tricks where she goes in to deliver the letter and he's pacing around like a maniac and comes up with the, if she doesn't come out soon, I'll go in and find her. So another one of those chasing Ellen moments, this time with a different take on it, but nonetheless, another one of those, I'm being pushed towards going towards her. And he looks at his watch and it's only been 3 minutes. The man is besotted. And yet there's none of this passion that I would have expected to get from them in this chapter. Maybe we'll get more in the next chapter. But for this one, for their first seeing, it seems awfully, well, on Newland's part, awfully nervous. Didn't it seem that way to you, that he kept kind of stopping and starting and not saying the right thing and kind of fnuffing all over the place trying to find the right words and sentences, and the way he kind of begged her to go out with him and spend the day, and she's just cool as a cucumber. And I suppose that's because she really holds all the cards, doesn't she? She's just turned her husband down again. And whether Newland loves her or not is almost immaterial, because it will always be up to her to decide whether or not any kind of affair moves forward, right? She could make a move if she wanted to, because she's that kind of strong woman, and Newland almost seems to expect it from her. And she could wait for Newland to make a move and have an affair start that way. So she's in this amazing position of power for a woman at this time. And I put power in quotation marks because, of course, it's within the restraints of that society and those rules that she's already, you know, skirting the outsides of. So Ellen continues to be a more and more interesting character. And don't forget about May. She will pick up again, and she is fascinating. But for this week, that's where we're going to end it. Next week, we will get to hear what Newland and Ellen have to say to each other. But until then, I will leave you. Have a great week. I will talk to you soon. Go check out Jasmine's Ethereal Socks by Meg Warren if you have a chance. You can find them on the Mama O blog. I'll put a link to them from the show notes. And, they're just all over the place. Or if you don't want to get individual sock patterns, if you'd rather just get the whole shebang, the ebook is available now. It's updated every time we have a new pattern released, which has been every 2 weeks so far. And you will get an updated file as soon as it's been released. So there you are. Have a great week. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.